All right, so we'll, three excellent papers, much to talk about, so I'll open it up for conversation. Yep, I'll start the questions and you can do that in the background, is that all right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, so for Erica and Stephen, I much enjoyed your paper and the written version, which I thought was very interesting. Just one thing I was thinking is more of a kind of a point for maybe the sort of the second half although they kind of predate the development of sort of chaos theory and complexity theory. You might find that actually some of the classical realists that you don't really sort of go into for obvious reasons might actually meet you halfway in the sense that the realism that you're criticising is a sort of a current realism which has become very thin. Ironically, because of people like Waltz, who, as you say, which I think was quite interesting, that actually have an element of complexity theory in their ideas, which I think makes for an interesting juxtaposition. But I'm thinking particularly the sort of the whole second debate over whether IR should be more traditional historical versus the sort of the scientism of the guys who eventually won out. And particularly I was thinking of people like Morgenthau, for example, who always sort of presented their system but then said, it was totally unstable and it required norms to make it stable. And that there's even sort of positive feedbacks in terms of Morgenthau and the way that he sees the balance of power. But also, people like Hedley Bull. We kind of know Hedley Bull from Anarchical Society, and where she talks about power. But he was planning on writing a companion piece on justice, but then he died. And actually, when you look in, there's all these references in Anarchical Society to what he's going to do next. And it's all these twin poles of power and justice. And much like the sort of, I forget the name for it now, but in chaos theory, there's that sort of model where, randomly the sort of system flips from one to the other. That bull's notion of power and justice is not a million miles away from that. Now, you can take that too far. I don't think that their radicalism only goes so far, but I think their use of history actually did introduce a sort of a complexity that is very sympathetic to what you want to do in terms of your a reanalysis of the international system.
Yeah, I can't say anything apart from completely agreeing, really. We engaged with Waltz because, it was particularly interesting in terms of that, just that kind of tiny little bit where he sort of says, there are emerging features. Oh, that's interesting. So, but, he only goes so far, so that, in a sense, that's why we kind of... But you're completely right, and, one of the major contributions in terms of thinking about sort of complexity approaches is bringing back those sort of historical accounts, in a way what you can do with complexity is think about how systems have developed and changed, so that the classical realists are much more, amenable to that kind of analysis. But, I think you're kind of overreading Morgenthau a little bit, because Morgenthau did see a very kind of definite separation, didn't he, between the kind of the international realm, the domestic realm, whereas we would want to see those as very much kind of open.
Oh no,
systems.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's only so far that you can use them, but there were little snippets of Morgenthau. Yeah. Morgenthau is like, yeah, you're almost there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cheers. I've got a quick question for each of the panellists. Really strong papers, really interesting as well. Thank you very much. First for Claire, two very quick questions. I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit on how you think Richard Day gets stuck, because you mentioned it a couple of times and wasn't quite sure exactly what the problem was with Richard Day's work. And the second question, more a provocative one, but one that a mate of mine, Matt Wilson, keeps going on about, is if you think your local Green MP is campaigning and achieving things that your local anarchist groups are not able to achieve, ought you to support your local Green MP? And Matt says yes. He doesn't vote for her, but he did actually support her and campaigned on her behalf. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. For Stephen and Erica, I kind of disagree with going back to the historical stuff, because I don't think these guys are sophisticated enough to deal with the complexity theory. But that said, I do think that people like Helen Milner and the way she understands interdependence as the critique of sort of this classic anarchy thing, I think her stuff might be really interesting. And the reason I mention that is because the way, when you talk about the balance of power as an emergent property, I don't see why that would have to be at the international level only. And I think she's basically going that way with her sort of comparative politics, you know, we need to get rid of this silly idea about anarchy and so on, blah, 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 because she sees the balance of power as something that operates within states as well as between them, and that we can have a much more complex understanding of the international system if we use the balance of power in those sorts of ways. And I thought that was, and I just wondered if you'd want to kind of reflect on that. And then a very quick one, what does panarchy mean? I was just wondering if you'd give me the etymology of that. And then, Nathan, really strong paper. And again, I have to tell you, you've got to get in touch with Matt Wilson, the same guy I was talking about, because you're doing really similar stuff. And not that it's complementary, and I think the two of you'd have a great chat. I want to bring up the question I mentioned yesterday, really, because I think we've had a bit of time to think about it. I'm just wondering if you could reflect on the global in your global assemblages and just sort of say a bit more about how you see this, how you understand this as a global thing. And then just a very quick point, when you talk about anarchism and you talk about assemblages, I always think you need to put an S at the end of anarchism, because there's never one. I think it's anarchisms, and I think that's the thing that really comes through with the way you're describing it, is that there's multiple forms of anarchism. I think talking about it in the plural really helps us get a grip on that, for me anyway. But thanks, really strong papers. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, to my mind, you answered your own question with your second. For me, Day gets stuck because he kind of valorizes and privileges this politics of the act as the only way in which politics should happen. And for me, that's the problem, is that he doesn't, it's more complex than that. It's not as simple as saying good politics, bad politics, because then we're just reinforcing, you know, the media create this good protester, bad protester stereotype when you're at, you know, summits and there's the peaceful, you know, Oxfam kind of march, and then there's the anarchists, and the media are kind of creating this binary, this kind of good versus bad, and that I'm suggesting that Day actually does something similar by getting a bit, he just sort of valorises the politics of the act as something that is always going to be preferable to the politics of mind, which, for an anarchist, yes, I think that's true, but I would maybe controversially suggest that actually we need the two together, and that's, so answering your second question, that's why, yes, maybe it's not unacceptable to say I'd vote for my Green MP because they're doing the kind of stuff that I would do, because I guess I'm kind of coming from a sort of a post-anarchist perspective where we're not, you know, where it's more about withdrawal from the state, but also rather than, you know, sort of destroying the state, but it's also about using the systems we've got to work. And I kind of would bring in Deleuze and Guattari in the way that in which they kind of conceptualise macropolitics and micropolitics as being in, you know, you can't separate them out. They're actually both kind of symbiotically connected, and that they relate to each other, and I'm not saying I agree, but he sort of suggests that you don't want to get rid of the macro politics, the state politics, because that's how we know how to exist, that's how we can connect with everybody else, and that's how stuff gets done. So sort of to suggest that a politics of the act is the only way in which politics should be enacted is where I kind of feel he falls down. So kind of answered your own question.
Panicky. I think they are using it to try and describe or to try and analyse specific kinds of co-constituted systems in particular arenas, though they often use it when they're talking about particular empirical cases. The term panicky itself, I remember when I first read their book, I thought that's quite a nice word, and then I thought, oh no, I hope they haven't committed the same disaster that Jim Lovelock did when he took the suggestion to call his theory of the Earth system the Gaia hypothesis, and they blimmin' well have. So there's some old trousers about the god Pan, and that's why they chose it. And I just think, no, because, you know, just as Jim Lovelock's no pagan, nor are they. So that's where they get the term from. But I think they're using it to try and analyse the interrelations of systems in particular cases. So it's the configurations of the systems, I think.
Well, something that attracts us about their approach is that they see social systems as different.
Yeah.
So that although, you know, social systems are embedded in a whole range of other non-social systems, you can think about those as operating in kind of different ways as well.
And I find very interesting the way some of these complexity scientists are talking about the need to, you know, someone like Kaufman talks about scientists have to do sociology because we need to theorise, you know, no more string theory, we need to go upwards, not downwards, and theorise more complexity. So yeah. It's quite interesting. And there are we talking about him and his theory of evolution, so.
Okay, balance of power. Yeah, I went back and hadn't looked at Milne's piece on anarchy. And I went back and read it kind of when we were writing the first parts of the paper, but I just noticed that it didn't actually kind of get in, or it wasn't actually discussed on the paper. I think, you know, in terms of the way that what we're trying to do is sort of think about how those kind of notions of emergence can be used in terms of thinking about international systems. And having spent most of my kind of time working in international relations, being a critic of kind of realist approaches, kind of using the word balance of power, kind of to be, oh, no, I can't say that, I can't say I'm becoming a realist. So that's why there's been a kind of certain hesitation
with
there,
the same
and
with
why I may have kind of, you know, in terms of the presentation, sort of, you know, going, well, okay, I'm going to try and slip this in here. I hope nobody kind of picked it. But Milner's piece, I think, is really excellent because she talks about, you know, the organisation in the international system, independence, and, you know, these aren't, you know, dual opposites.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that they, you know, realists have often depicted them.
Yeah. Would that be a better place to start than Waltz, perhaps, though? Because I've read the paper, and I was just wondering whether, because, again, it's kind of like the snippet stuff, and I'm not sure whether it might be a stronger entry point for the piece to start with somebody like Milner and the comparativists rather than the realists. I think we all know what the limitations are, but I think there's more scope for sort of really expanding the argument because they do so much more in the comparativist literature and sort of interdependent stuff. And people like Kerhain and Axelrod have both done complexity stuff, and then people like Emilian, just published a piece, did a piece in International Affairs or whatever. He uses people like Rosenau, who's also done stuff on complexity, so, and Colin White, of course, who in his Agents and Structures, but there's loads of stuff in there about, not loads, but a fair amount of appreciation and complexity and how you might link that to people like, yeah.
Okay, so as to the global, assemblage concept has sort of had particular traction within like the global governmentality literatures, precisely for the way in which it allows us to think about emergent concepts, to thinking, you know, there's a bit, you taking the example of, say, globalization or neoliberalism, like how do we think these emergent global forms without confining them to the characteristics, you know, to the characteristics of X, or how do we account for the heterogeneity of outcomes or in different contexts, yet still talk about something which exists but without reifying it as this out there, you know. Such the critiques about, around globalization, people saying, oh, well, the more you talk and talk about globalization, your discourse is actually rarefied to the extent which it becomes an impossible thing to actually counteract. And so although it's been used to talk about broadly oppressive global forms, I think it can be used to talk about emancipatory global forms, and it's useful because it doesn't... It's interesting, in the assemblage literature, this concept of emergence is quite different because one's coming from a sort of continental philosophy perspective, one's coming from a more science perspective. And so in the philosophical perspective, emergence refers to the degree to which things are never fully actualized, or the sense in which everything is always already becoming or incomplete. And so, for me, that's a great way of thinking anarchism, because, like, because if anarchism's infinitely is simultaneously infinitely demanding, yet prefigurative, then it's necessarily self-consciously always already incomplete, because you're taking direct action, you're living it in the here and now, but you're still striving towards something constantly, so you're always arriving, but you're never arriving. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a useful way to think about the global without reifying global forms, basically. And I suppose the reason that I don't talk about anarchisms is precisely because I think this concept of assemblage allows us to talk about multiplicity, allows us to identify a sort of singular object without the implication that a singular object means that it has to be homogeneous, so that it can, and that my act of identifying it is, you know, is that's an exercise of my power, and but I'm recognizing that it at this time. So I suppose that's why I would still stick with anarchism.
Awesome presentations. I really love all three of these papers. I had two questions for Claire and Nathan. I guess sort of two questions for both. For Claire, on the issue of framing, you sort of define it as though as the frame is determined by leadership, and I wonder if that's necessarily always the case, and if whether framing can be a collective process, and you know, not necessarily a single collective, but you know, multiple a frame that's constantly renegotiated and incomplete. Whether that happens within social movements or is possible, and how that would jive with an anarchist politics. And secondly, on the question of equality through action and the reading of Rancière, I agree that when thinking about it in terms of the politics of the act, a presupposition of equality seems to again jive with it, sort of anarchist politics. But you know, thinking back to Rancière, I mean, I think particularly about who is the subject of the rights of man, and some of the stuff in disagreement, that it seems that the claims towards equality, or while there is that presupposition, there is a recognition that that's not the reality, and that those are then demands that are placed on the state, saying that, you know, we are equal, but we're not being treated as such, and therefore you as the state or some sort of authority has to grant us the equality that we're promised, and how you can reconcile that with the way that you're reading it. And then for Nathan, I wonder on the difference between ethics and discipline, and whether it seems to me discipline has, you know, certainly this sort of negative connotation in the, you know, the Foucauldian way that it's used, and you want to reinterpret it as not necessarily so, but that, you know, sort of a necessary way to sort of wrangle empowerment, wrangle organization into empowering forms, but how you would differentiate that between ethics, and then building off of that, I mean, I think Foucault talks a lot about ethics of the self, and whether there are collective ethics and how those would be produced, and then perhaps how that would be different from disciplinary or governmental forms.
On the issue of framing, I mean, I think yes, that there are multiple sort of ways of framing and collective process, but that's just not something that comes across very much in the social movement theory literature, because they're very they're just very focused on the kind of things that they're suggesting, which is mainly that, especially from a political process point of view, they're suggesting that I guess I mean, if it's a smaller, you know, small movement, then yes, more people would have a say in how the movements fall, but they're suggesting that it's kind of similar to Gramsci's kind of, you know, organic intellectual, that they're suggesting that somebody needs to have a good enough understanding of the state or the system to know when and how best to attack the system. So they're suggesting that the grievance that they might come up with, for example, doesn't always isn't always their main concern, but it's the one they think will actually achieve something. So so it's about and framing can kind of, they can have master frames which connect a whole load of different kind of ideas, you know, or problems into one kind of overarching frame. So that they very much suggest that that leadership kind of is necessary. And sort of, it's slightly different to resource mobilisation theory, which because instead of suggesting, which is that's very much based on the fact that the resources are the people, and therefore there needs to be a leader in order to, you know, and people who are willing to follow in order for a movement to happen. Whereas progressive theory is looking more at the actual processes of politics. And, but they very much suggest that it's something that is, but I don't agree with that. On the second point about Rancière, I must admit I'm not particularly well schooled in Rancière. It's kind of something I've come to quite lately, so I'm still working through. So that's helpful. But I think one of the things I'm suggesting is that that kind of, you know, demand for equality, the things that we need to demand, is that the Policies of the Act may be an ideal kind of type, but it's not always possible, which is going back to the whole kind of thing of why we need to connect the politics, why we need to understand that we're not always going to be able to practice the Policies of the Act all of the time. And that's where, you know, we need that kind of, also to fight for what we actually need. I've not come across that, but I'll read it more closely. But I think that it just goes, again, to prove that we actually kind of need both, because it's a very, especially if you look at something like Hacking Bay or others, it's a very kind of white middle class thing. Oh yeah, I've got time to just go out and create a temporary autonomous zone. I don't have, you know, no one's going to come and, you know, I've got food on the table. I don't have to, I can take a day off work or not even work because I'm that kind of, you know, it's kind of very May 68 students wandering around going, oh look, we can do, you know, it's not people, you know, the guys who are coming up with some of these theories aren't the people, you know, on the sharp end, are they? They're not the people who are sort of in Bolivia or places like, you know, like April was talking about yesterday, who don't have access to, you know, water or food. And so it's kind of a very much a type, a mode of politics, but it's not to say that they're mutually exclusive. So I guess I could use Rancière, or I could argue about him, but I think that's really helpful.
Okay. Can I just contribute to this point as well? Like, I strongly feel that the politics of demand and the politics of the Act are completely counterposed and mutually exclusive. And I would propose that although Rancière does accept certain engagements with the state, he argues for a politics that, to put it simply, is one where you fight where you stand with the tools available. And in certain cases, that means using those mechanisms available to you that are provided by the state, but you're through the presupposition of equality of everyone. You're exercising those rights in an infinitely demanding way. So you're taking what's given, that in a way that completely outstrips or demands it beyond any possible comprehension that the state could ever possibly provide. So it isn't the difference between made poverty history and the, you know, dissent was that made poverty history was making possible demands and dissent was making impossible demands. Because if you make possible demands, they'll meet you in the middle. And if you make impossible demands, then it completely undermines them. And I think we really, really need to say, you know, if we're talking about post-politics, a politics where the antagonistic dimension of the political has been reduced or has been obliterated to, you know, a consensus between, you know, some kind of plural range of positions where everyone can fit, and we can have a politics of demand happening over here and then, you know, a negative politics happening over there, then we negate the antagonistic character of the political. And we need to confront these positions because they're not compatible. And I think that, like, a politics of the Act isn't just going up and setting up a temporary autonomous zone. You know, it's also smashing the windows of a bank. It's planting a permaculture garden. It's smiling at your neighbours. You know, it's throwing a Molotov. It's doing all these things. It's doing these militant things, and it's doing these non-militant things, supposedly. But these are all politics of the Act. And that would include, like, enacting the rights that we have in an infinitely demanding way. So sorry, so just chuck my two pennies worth in there.
I do go into some of them in the paper, yeah. The kind of more practical aspects of it.
Fair play, yeah, sorry. Everything is sort of, you cram things in for a small amount of time and stuff like that. But yeah, on the kind of ethics, disciplinarity, discipline thing, May, following Foucault, notes that although power is always a matter of constraints upon action, it does not imply we must define constraints in terms of restraints. So, in other words, power is everywhere, but domination isn't. So, Foucault's not conceptualizing power or discipline as negative, necessarily. Because he also conceptualizes power as productive. And so similarly, I'm thinking about how we can have, there's always going to be power running through our practices, like we discipline ourselves in accordance with an ethical regime, you know, and what we're arguing for is the ability to create our own ethical regime and to discipline ourselves in accordance with it, you know. Every time you choose to not have that meat that smells so great, you're self-governing, or you're autonomously self-governing. So you are disciplining yourself through these various actions, you know. So what I'm arguing for is, say, like, we're never going to get away from that completely, but we can minimise domination, and we can also minimise the way we dominate others, and minimise the way we dominate ourselves by being reflective about those processes. Does that kind of get to it?
Yeah, I mean, the other concern was just sort of about ethics of the self versus collective ethics.
Whether okay.
Ethics can be something that is collectively determined.
Yeah.
Way,
yeah.
Or
yeah.
Something individual.
No, I think that's really important, and I think that is one of the big differences between, say, an anarchist subject is mutually constituted, and say a liberal or neoliberal subject, which is defined in relation to the state, where the forms, the governmentality theorists are basically critiquing people being empowered, you know, welfare to workfare. You know, you empowered people on the dole, you're no longer on welfare, you're on workfare. So that, and you know, there's countless examples where, you know, people in developing countries are being empowered to create their own solutions. And what these strategies are doing is, or say like microcredit schemes, for women in India, you're basically, I'm not saying all of them do this, but you know, they're being critiqued, which is saying, okay, you're basically constructing a rational economic female subject who is empowered to take decisions in accordance with a particular set of rationalities around capitalism. And so precisely what we're arguing for is the power to collectively define the rationalities by which we empower ourselves. And so, and those rationalities are ethics, like our egalitarian ethics.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, Eric and Steve, but I've got a question for Claire and Nathan again. three really good papers. And yeah, Claire, like, I really like this. I think it's a really useful corrective or, you know, move on date. What I'm still struggling with myself, as much as generally, is where we draw these lines and where we pick and choose, and how we sort of not rank but deal with what I think are distinctions between the act and the demand. Because I think to judge on outcomes, which I don't think you do, but I think it's occasionally hinted, seems to beg the question a little in terms of, you know, presupposing the horizontal, vertical, you know, divides and such. And I wonder if it's not necessarily the act of the act or the act of the demand, but the approach we take to the act and the approach we take to the demand. So I wonder if there are certain lines in terms of particularly the struggle and the politics of how we do those things. So as you use the example, someone tends to dominate discussions, but we also struggle with that and write books about the problems with that. Whereas I think when it comes to the politics of demand, often, not always, but often, with that demand comes a happy coherence and a sidelining of those internal struggles. And you quoted some great Kalinikos quotes in your paper, I think, that exemplify that. Whereas I think the politics of act, more often than not, is worried about those internal politics and that internal struggle and how that motivates. And I wonder if that can be an interesting line along how we sort of start to see the decisions that have to be made within those decisions between moments of demand and moments of act, or moments of contending between the two. And I just wondered what you thought of that, because I have no idea.
We might just leave it at that question, because we've got another two people who also want, and we've only got 10 minutes, if that's all right.
No, absolutely fine.
Sorry.
Oh, that's really interesting. I think that's really good. Actually, to go back to something we were talking about yesterday, and I wanted to come back to you on that, was you asked a question about the kind of whether it, what was it, what you're saying, about kind of whether it's kind of protests or whether it's the internal building of, you know, you were suggesting that there were these, that we separated out kind of the different aspects of direct action that Abdana was talking about, with kind of as to protest and as to internal building kind of from within. And I was thinking that maybe that's actually, maybe they're not two separate things, they're just the way in which you orientate yourself depending on who you're looking at, whether you're looking externally at your enemy or whether you're looking internally. And like, yeah, I think you're right to suggest that the politics of the act is a bit more kind of looking internally at how we kind of how we manage these kind of processes, and because that's as much about the act as, whereas the demand is a bit more kind of instrumental. It's a bit more, you know, how do we achieve things. But I think I will take a lot of thought over to how we might measure the two, because I think that's really interesting. So sorry, that's not really an answer. That's just a waffle. But you know.
Okay,
thanks. I was really interested in the application of complexity theory to international politics, and I actually think that the current environmental crisis really exemplifies this approach, because on the one hand it highlights the interdependence within the system and how we're all dependent on a great ecosystem, but it also shows that actually some things are beyond state boundaries, so it demolishes the idea of states as separate entities. And it also shows the inability of the current system of states and state-based international organization to deal with conflicts that are on the international level, or crises that are beyond states. And especially in relation to the paper about the politics of demand, it also shows the inability of the politics of demand in expecting states to solve things in actually solving environmental crises.
We agree?
Yes.
Wait, can we get a plug in for our book? That's basically the plot of the book. Okay. So it's, I mean, the book is bringing together complexity theory, ecologism, and international relations. Mm-hmm. All the points you make will be in there.
Is it for clear also? Modern represents or frames the Zapatistas in a very particular way. He is using Gramsci, and he finds what he is supposed to find when he looks at the Zapatistas. And that makes it really difficult using modern to explain what the Zapatistas are all about. On page 5, I have some problems understanding whether it is modern who speaks or if it's you. Especially when you say, or Morton is saying that, yeah. There's still an element of blah 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 intended to result in the meeting of specific demands, like politics of demands. If you use the perspective politics of action to the Zapatistas, you could see lots of really deep, interesting, fascinating things going on. The local structures, the procedures, the institutions they have, municipalities, they have the caracoles, they have schooling systems, health systems, all outside states. So I'm not quite sure if Morton, or basing the argument on Morton, makes it possible even to be fair to the Zapatistas.
What I probably haven't made clear enough in that is I'm not actually, I mean, elsewhere in, you know, in work I'm doing, I'm suggesting that the Zapatistas, you know, can be kind of integrated into anarchist politics. I mean, I think that's the most funny thing about the Zapatistas, is everybody claims. Everybody says they're, you know, we're following them. You know, everybody claims it. So what I'm doing, I'm not suggesting it's me saying that. I'm suggesting this is how I'm not speaking there about how what the Zapatistas are or what they're doing. I'm speaking about how Morton is using a kind of Gramscian framework to see them. So exactly what you say. He finds what he looks for because that's what he. But I'm not suggesting that I think that's how the Zapatistas are working. I'm suggesting that that's how Morton is. is commenting on that kind of situation and using it in that way, because, you know, from a Gramscian framework, you can find all those things, but the thing with the Zapatistas is you can find all those things whoever you are, whatever you're looking for, because everybody sort of wants to claim them as their own.
Any more questions?
Just a very brief one from Nathan. At one point you were talking about the gold dust, the real thing, the people who are from the community are not activists. It just struck me in a way, you just seem to be like re-describing what Lenin wrote in 1902, where you have people who are economists who, you know, are the real thing, they're on the factory doing, not really, they don't really know what they're doing, and then we have these people who study Karl Kautsky, who do know, and Karl Marx, who do know what these people on the factory floor are doing, and they have to be taught, scientific consciousness to understand I'm not quite sure where you're putting yourself in there, or are you saying this problem is the perennial problem of the division of labor between varieties of knowledge and so on?
Okay, I suppose I probably didn't make that clear enough because I was kind of blitzing through. Yeah. What I'm referring to is the way in which there can be a patronizing relationship between people who perform a particular activist identity and members of a supposed community.
Yeah.
So members of a supposed community would come to a meeting and be regarded as somehow representatives of said supposed community. And
yeah.
what I'm saying is that the very fact that they're over-valorized is
right.
equally patronizing as not listening to them. It's the same
right.
thing that, you know, it's actually, you know, it's like what the local council send round a thing saying, we really care about your opinions, please tell us what you think. And it's just like, no, this is completely the wrong approach. You know, it's just,
right.
Either you don't care about what I think, and if you do, you're going about it the wrong way, because the very way that you're phrasing it sets up this unequal relationship by which you're kind of over-valorizing them and empowering yourself to solve their problem,
mm-hmm.
rather than approaching someone on the basis of solidarity.
So your solution is that everyone should treat everyone equally?
Well, that would be nice, yeah.
What you're describing, but a kind of human, I mean, what is it, what are you trying to get at? That's, I mean,
I'm trying to think how we have more empowering, more participatory relationships
right.
without it sort of going
yeah.
down into more, without it
yeah.
becoming another hierarchical relationship. I mean, another example that I use in the paper is that, it's not uncommon for, say, white male activists
mm.
to go and ask the one or two female
mm.
or the one or two people of colour in the group and say, hey, what can we do to get more of you people, you know, like
mm.
more like black people involved or more women involved?
Mm.
And it's like, okay, yeah, you know, that comes from a genuine concern, but that the very way that that's being phrased and the way that there's no sort of reflexivity about the way that that's done basically normalizes white male as valid participants.
Well, isn't it, I know we have to stop now, but I just one point I'd make, more mainstream literature, but something very mainstream, is, I mean, really what you're talking about is the dilemma when you get encounter in community organizing literature. I mean, Saul Alinsky
yeah.
is a good example, and that famous anarchist Barack Obama, in his memoir, actually talks about this in a curious way,
mm.
working in house, in the South Side of Chicago. So that's what we're really talking about. There's an old dilemma about community organizing and how are people to do things.
Definitely.
Without being a puppeteer about patronizing.
Yeah, yeah, and so what I'm looking to is that the governmentality literature is precisely critiquing those older forms of community organizing, but it doesn't engage with the anarchist literature at all.
Yeah.
And so it's trying to think what can anarchist perspectives bring to forms of community organizing to think how we can...
Well, one final point,
well,
this community
yeah.
organizing, some of it actually comes from an anarchist background. I mean, if you look at you look at Alinsky, he's tied to Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement, which was anarchist in its own.
All right. Let's thank all the panelists.
Yeah, I hope so.